Hello and welcome to this week's emergency instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. This week, our attention turns to one of the most volatile periods in money markets we have seen for a century. We thought, given the uncertainty, volatility, and confusion, that it was a great time to reflect on our own take on some of the key areas of focus in these troubling times. So join our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen, Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith, and myself, Tim Fuller, as we update and reflect on the COVID impacts on local and overseas markets. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. I hope you enjoy. So our agenda for today is we're going to start by looking at a virus update. We'll then roll our attention through to the credit markets, the stock market, the property market, the view to potential stimulus, the big question, when to buy back in again. And then, of course, we'll hand over to our panel that we have for a series of questions as well that have come in throughout this morning. So to kick us off, I'll hand over to Damien for our virus update.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Obviously, there's for anyone sort of watching the numbers, it's gone vertical in a number. The number of cases has gone vertical in a whole bunch of countries around the world. You know, our take was always that the is it Europe, in particular France, Germany, and also in the US, were not well situated for slowing the spread, and that it's gonna really take off in those markets. I think there's been some concerning signs. We popped up a post today just on the summer versus winter. So for most of February, it really seemed as if summer and tropical countries weren't really catching the disease. It seemed to be mainly from travelers in those countries, and sometimes you'd sort of get one step of virus transfer. But now we've actually seen this real outbreak occur in the last for the last probably week or so. The sort of days to double of cases in summer countries and in tropical countries has really taken off. Australia, Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia, all of those are sort of having quite dramatic increases. And so that whole idea that summer slows it down, I certainly haven't given up on that idea in terms of I do think it does slow it down in terms of the heat or the humidity. However, it's clearly having an impact, and you are getting local transmission in all those economies, which basically says to me that those economies will need to put in the quarantines and the shutdowns and the travel bans and all that type of factors, which means from an investment perspective, the difference isn't going to be that much between the countries that are have real massive outbreaks and the ones that have sort of low level outbreaks but need to do all the quarantine measures anyway to make sure that it doesn't become a massive outbreak.
And so, Damien, we've obviously seen with Australia, a rapid rise off a very, very low base, which sort of falls in lockstep. And you've been putting through in a lot of that analysis you've been doing on our page, on our website. Do you feel that this is, we're following in the footsteps of something like Italy or, you know, some of those Western countries that have now obviously blown up?
Yeah, well, it's it does look that way, and it looks as if it's that way because we've chosen to sort of do things in that way. I think there's been the difference between some of the countries they haven't even really put quarantines and things like that on in places like Singapore and South Korea, but they are saying to everyone stay home and don't get out, and people are generally sort of doing that, which is certainly slowing it down. I think there's, in Australia, we tried very hard to cover this Grand Prix before it finally got cancelled, effectively by the drivers and the teams themselves, rather than by us. There's been the Cricket World Cup. We've had this issue with religious gatherings in South Korea and now in Malaysia. Is sort of a lot of these outbreaks are coming from big religious gatherings. And we sort of, had a massive Hillsong conference all weekend. And so all the mistakes that other countries have made are being made in Australia at the moment. You have to worry about that.
More of the same to be expected.
Yeah, and it does seem as if countries tend to go, well, that probably won't happen to us. Yes, it's happened to this other country that's exactly like us, but that probably won't happen to us. And then so let's keep doing our thing until it starts getting out of control. And at that stage, it's almost, you know, the question is it too late at that stage where, you know, once you put in your, once you put in your checks and you're really trying to slow things down, it takes about 10 days before that's going to make actually take an effect. And so, and this virus is doubling every 2 or 3 days in most countries. So you put that in and now you've doubled, you know, another 5 times, you're 10 times, you know, you've got 10 times the cases or more, by the time the things you do today are actually going to affect it. And so, that's the concern, is that, look, it probably is a bit slower in whether it's a light, a humidity or a heat, what, you know, we really don't know which one of those it is. But if you don't put on the social distancing and you don't sort of put on those sort of travel bans and get people to change behaviours, then you end up in a similar situation. Maybe it won't be as bad, but it certainly seems like it's similar. And the other scary thing for
we should add, of course, is that Australia's seasonality is particularly bad, given we have the accelerating virus at the tail end of summer, and we're going into winter. So that acceleration is going to become much more difficult to combat, and the shutdown will have to go much longer.
Yeah, and you have to wonder if there'd be some sort of fatigue. So, and that actually applies to, it's not just Australia. So obviously there's it applies to anyone in the Southern Hemisphere, is that you've got this idea that, okay, we get this first wave of the virus now while we're getting lots of cases from the Northern Hemisphere. And then let's say over the next sort of 3 months that the virus sort of naturally starts to burn itself out, plus you get the start of summer and that might slow it down a bit more in the Northern Hemisphere. But just as that's happening, conditions in the Southern Hemisphere become even worse. And so then you find that Australia and Southern Hemisphere countries have to go through this lockdown procedure again. And whether that's going to make a difference. So there's that part. And the other thing is, if you look at sort of Southeast Asia and tropical countries, is what you find within those is that that their worst flu season is usually between August and sort of October. So, you know, they're in that same batch as Australia in terms of susceptibility to that sort of second wave of the virus.
Yeah, the Australian virus peak is typically October. August.
August.
Okay. It can come a bit earlier, but generally around August.
So that's the flu. This is the flu.
Flu season. Yeah. So, yep. I mean, you're looking at a shutdown that runs through October, probably.
Right. Fascinating. All right. Very good. So maybe perhaps at this point we'll roll across to a review of the markets. And we've got top of the list here, the credit markets.
Yeah. Well, what a week it's been on credit markets. We went transitioned almost unbelievably quickly from nobody caring what at all and to caring about nothing else. We've watched credit markets melt down across the board over the last 2 weeks. We've had interbank markets seizing up coming out of the US. We've had corporate debt markets freezing, and it just intensified and intensified over the last 2 weeks to the point where we started to get dislocations in the deepest, most liquid bond markets in the world, in the treasury market in the US. At the end of last week, it started to dislocate, and even though, you know, the outlook was obviously crashing and shares were, you know, falling at the fastest rate since 1929, and I think even faster than 1929, bond yields started to rise. And that's basically what forced the big Fed bazooka over the weekend when we got QE5 and other things, because markets were almost completely frozen, credit markets globally. And that's why we've been jumping up and down trying to prod the RBA into action here, because we got all of those implications flowed through to local funding costs as well. So you know, central banks have kind of gotten on the front foot finally. Certainly not enough yet, but starting to. But at this stage, global credit markets are effectively still frozen.
Mm. And we've seen a number of capital notes get cancelled, issued capital notes, I noticed, were cancelled last week through all the turmoil as well. Macquarie, I think, from memory, and NAB. It was fascinating to sort of see, you know, at the top end that there's some hesitation as well to write more debt.
Yeah, I think it's also worth...
Yeah,
I think it's worth, though, distinguishing between the corporate debt markets, which are very much closed, and you're just not seeing. You know, I think that if you want to sell in the if you want to sell in size in that market, then people think that you're desperate, and so they're gonna make you pay for it.
Right.
Whereas the government bond markets that David was talking about, they're still quite liquid. Not as liquid as they've been in the past, but they're still quite liquid. And I guess the issue within those markets is more that the thought. Actually, sorry, David, do you mind when you're not speaking, just muting your muting yours? Yeah, because I'm getting lots of background noise from yours. So it's worth noting the difference between the corporate debt market and the government debt market. Where in the government debt market, although it's the liquidity is much lower, there still certainly is that liquidity around, and that's what the issue has been: is that people are selling anything they can. So especially there's this a thing called a risk parity trade, and effectively what the risk parity is it's you basically take.
Sorry, Dave, just with your mic, Dave, with your mic, just you've clicked the hand, not the microphone. Thing below. Yep, there you go. I'll just get old mate to edit that one out.
Thanks. Yeah, so the...
Go ahead, Damon.
Yeah, so the issue... Sorry, what was I saying? Fuck, I've completely lost my train of thought now.
Debt markets versus federal markets, liquidity.
Yes. Risk parity trade, that's right. Yeah, so we've got this risk parity trade that's unwinding, and what the risk parity effectively is you take an equity portfolio and a bond portfolio, so a split portfolio, and you basically leverage up your bond part to match the volatility of your equities. So the net effect really, the maths is quite elegant, and you know there's a long history and shows some quite good returns. But in the end, you know, if you just take a step back, what you started with was an equity and a bond portfolio, and then what you finish up with is an equity and a bond portfolio and debt. So it's effectively just a leveraged asset allocation play. And within that, that's starting to unwind. So people have now, with all the volatility, they've decided they don't want the debt. And so because there's because they don't want the debt, now they're selling anything they can. And because they can't sell corporate bonds because they're all locked up, equities are free falling. And so they're going through and selling the bond portfolio as well, which has sort of then needed the central banks to step in to sort of help solve that. The issue is central banks... can solve that issue. What they can't solve is the corporate debt side, and they also and also the stock side. Although having said that, the Japanese central bank is out buying stocks, but yeah, there's certain limitations on what they can do on that front.
So does that give you confidence, I guess, and obviously with our investments in the Australian federal bond market solely, Damien, does that give you confidence that there is a government backstop for liquidity in those style investments?
Yeah, certainly. Certainly much more so than corporate debt markets. And that's why we sort of treat corporate debt as a risk holding. So there's a lot of people who, especially a lot of financial advisors, who will put things like hybrids and other sort of corporate debt instruments in as like into somebody's portfolio and saying, oh, these are there to keep you safe. And we're showing exactly why we don't think that's the case right now is because they don't keep you safe. When equity markets take huge tumbles, those things, the spreads blow out and you lose money on it. So really from a hedging perspective, you want the government debt, which has come down dramatically in terms of the yields. And so what that means is the price of that government debt has risen. And that sort of helps shield you from the effects of the downturn.
There was, you know, as I said though, late last week, those markets started to dislocate. But it was always the case that the RBA would be forced to come in that eventuality. Because, I mean, that's what you call the risk-free rate off which everything else prices in the markets. Mm. And the fundamental role of a central bank, you know, is to be the lender of last resort. Most of the time it's not even setting interest rates. It's just chasing bond markets around that are setting it for them. Mm-hmm. And there's all these other duties that have been piled on top. But the fundamental reason we have a central bank at all is that when those markets freeze, there is someone to backstop it and, yep. And come in. And to do that, you simply need to stand up and say, we'll do whatever it takes and we'll do the QE and print the money and buy the bonds. And that's what the RBA has basically been forced to do this week, along with, you know, a variety of other central banks around the world. So, you know, you're talking about the safest. These are the safest and most liquid markets in the world.
Yes, and I think that's the point, David, is I'll just reiterate your point there, is that, you know, a lot of people think central banks are there to raise and lower interest rates and to control inflation and unemployment. But that function didn't come for, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 years after they first started. Like the original function was exactly what they're meant to be doing now, which is when there's banking panics or there's less liquidity, they're there to step in and be that lender of last resort. So, yeah, that's their primary function. And yeah. Then the interest rates and some of the, you know, prudential stuff they do elsewhere is sort of like that's been an add-on to that, saying, well, because you're not doing anything for most of your time, why didn't you do this as well?
Yeah, I mean, so Australian yields did jackknife higher along with US as these markets froze up late last week. And when the RBA came out yesterday, those yields fell sharply again. But they've actually been rising since because, you know, as usual, even when the RBA calls an emergency meeting, it takes 4 days. And so we're waiting until Thursday to see what kind of QE it's actually going to deliver. And so the market's testing the RBA a bit, pushing back and selling where it can out of those bonds. But, you know, the RBA has basically mooted yield curve control as the most likely kind of QE it would do. I hope it goes that way because that's basically a commitment to unlimited bond purchases to hit certain yields. And that would flatten the curve. And it means, you know, that safe haven is once again operable for everybody. So that's what I expect to happen. And they have no choice, basically. They have to bring those yields down or you end up seeing blown interest rates through all markets because this is the base rate for everything.
Mm, yeah, it's a good point. All right. Shall we turn our attention now to the stock markets?
Yeah, sorry. I just wanted to say one more thing on the central banks before we moved on from that, is that one of the things with them is there's all these problems going on at the moment. Obviously, there's this virus. There's economic shutdowns. They're trying to get governments to get out to spend money. We've got corporate debt markets locked up, and we've got government bond yields starting to rise. And when we say starting to rise, they're still below where we were at the start of the crisis. So yeah, from a portfolio perspective, they've still acted the way you're meant to. Just under reverse. Of all those problems, there's one that's very easy for central banks to solve, which is they can just spend money and get the government bond yields back down again, and that's what we're expecting to happen. The other problems are obviously a lot harder. So, you know, when you're faced with five very difficult problems and you know you can solve one of them, we're expecting central banks to really step up and solve that problem they know they can solve. Sorry, back across the market.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, we'll kick off now with stock markets. Yep.
So, yeah, well, I mean, it's been a historical couple of weeks of selling, fastest move, as I said, since 1929. I'm pretty sure it's faster than 1929, so considerably faster and deeper falls than the GFC over that selected time frame.
It is faster, David.
You know, virtually nothing.
It is faster, but
I'll faster than 29.
Yeah, but I'll only add the disclaimer that, you know, in 1929 you had to wait for the newspaper to get delivered before you could actually place your trades and all that type of stuff. So it's of a similar speed.
Yeah.
Adjusted for technology, I suspect 1929 would have been faster, but we're in that same part.
Yeah. So I mean, we went into this with, you know, very high valuations, extreme sentiment to the positive that we were going to get this massive global rebound in earnings. We were already very dubious on, and so we came into it at completely the wrong setup. And then, you know, the easing that was mooted for dealing with the virus when it was considered to be no worse than SARS sent that even higher. And, you know, as it dawned on markets that it was actually something else, then they've had a great deal of trouble with price discovery. How do you price a global pandemic and rolling shutdown of the global economy? I mean, it is just a slippery slope to hell. And so that's where equity markets are. I don't expect central bank action to have much impact on equities. I think, you know, most people who are sort of saying that the central banks are failing because they've been unable to lift equities are barking entirely up the wrong tree. Central bank's job is the credit market, not equities. And it looks like they're on the move to help stabilize that. Well, it may help equities, but, you know, at this stage, we're still at high valuations and we've done nothing like the discounting to earnings that's going to be required given we're going into these immense shutdowns. Goldman's out yesterday saying US economy is going to fall 5% in Q2. Mm. You know, but everyone still has a V-shaped recovery in their outlooks for Q3. Which we think is pretty preposterous. Certainly the virus should start to clear in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, into June and into summer, as Damo has described, but it'll have a long tail and you've got to sustain those shutdowns to keep curve flat for the virus. And so as we're seeing in China now, the revival of economic activity is sluggish, takes time, and that's before we get into any of the really serious outcomes here, which is when you wipe out 5 and 10% of GDP globally over a very short period of time, you're obviously going to have some pretty cataclysmic results for big, very large companies, irrespective of stimulus, fiscal and monetary. So, you know, we almost certainly will see some major bankruptcies as well. And so very little of that is discounted yet into the earnings outlook. And so, you know, it's onward and downward. You want to add to that, Damo?
I think it's one of these trying to work out where the bottom is. And there's certainly a lot of people out there trying to catch falling knives at the moment saying, you know, this is a time to buy, this is a time to buy, it's time to get greedy and all those types of factors. And look, you know, if you took a 10-year view on it or a 5-year view on it, you're probably right at this point. I think the point I'd make is that we've got to remember where we started from. Like, we started from PEs of sort of which is price to earnings ratio of about 30% higher than what their longer term average was. And so you sort of had about a 20 to 30% fall before you actually came back to the level where you'd say, okay, now things are cheap. And so that's the first part. And that was before, that's if you assume earnings didn't get affected at all. And so that's the real thing for me, saying, well, how much further do we need to fall before you can actually look at prices that you can get it for stocks in aggregate and say, yeah, this is actually cheap based on long-term earnings and bounce backs and all that type of factor. And we're only really just getting to the stage now where you'd say, okay, on a longer term basis, if I'm buying today, maybe it's cheap. It's still borderline. And if we do get earnings falling, then it doesn't look cheap anymore. If you sort of make it, and what I'm saying there is, if you make an assumption that some of the earnings seen over the last few years is a matter of, and especially the earnings growth has been based on gearing up balance sheets at very low interest rates to levels where they shouldn't be that geared. And so if that has to unwind, then earnings are going to be a little bit lower. The second part is supply chains have gone to everything sort of as narrow as you can get it. And you know, everything's based on this whole just-in-time. I don't want all this money tied up in my supply chain. I want to make sure that, you know, I want to release that money back to shareholders. Well, given what we've seen in supply shocks and factors like that, companies aren't going to be doing that over the next few years. There's going to be, they're going to be adding some extra fat into the supply chain. So that's going to require more capital to be put into their inventory and their that whole supply bit. And so that's going to reduce returns as well. But then just the whole globalization. You know, if I can ship everything to China and get them all to do it there at a lower cost, then that's great. And that's what the case has been for the last few years, is just incremental gains. Now we're going to see that work in the other opposite direction, where companies now need to go and say, well, having everything based in China was not a good idea. I actually need three or four different areas where I'm going to produce this. And so that means that the cost at each one of those, rather than having one big factory doing everything, I'm going to need four smaller factories. And so there's going to be an incremental cost to that. And so that means earnings aren't going to be as high. And then that's just the supply side. Then we get to the demand side and saying, well, are consumers going to, after being locked up in their house for 2, 3, 4 weeks or whatever, are they going to rush out and spend as much money as possible on discretionary goods? And I'd argue that it's the same for them, and especially people who whose work is more sporadic, or they work for themselves, or they have casuals or whatever. They're going to be sitting looking at their finances saying, I've just run down whatever savings I had, and I better make sure I've actually got a much bigger nest egg for in case this happens again. So that I've actually got, you know, and so I think there's going to be a natural pullback in demand as well. So I think there's a whole bunch of factors which sort of lead to earnings falling relatively significantly. And you know, it's not going to be a V-shaped recovery. I think there will be a very sharp bounce off the bottom, but I think what you find is that the bottom of that V is a long way, lot further down than what people were expecting, and it won't bounce back up as high as what you're expecting for all those reasons I just spoke about.
So effectively, the recovery is going to be a lot more prolonged than what you'd expect, ex maybe a white swan event or something like that, Damien.
I'll add as well. Like we don't know yet. You know, this massive earnings blow is going to not just on in terms of you know, large listed stocks, but it's absolutely going to smash the small and medium sector, and that's a wave of bad debt globally into the banking system. And we haven't seen the likes of that in Australia since 1991. And so the banks are, this is not like the GFC in the sense that it didn't start with the banks, which then, you know, locked up and hit markets and then the economy. Okay, it started with a virus, which has locked up the economy, but it's going to end with banks. No, there's so much economic carnage here that even the banks, now that with their improved capital, you know, are facing a tsunami of bad debt here, along with a range of other profit crushes like QE hitting their margins, like the rising funding costs in credit markets that we've already described. There is also in terms of the recovery, you know, there's going to be a period here where the banks are going to be chewing through this bad debt. They're going to have, you know, they're going to be capital constrained, basically. So you're going to see a lot of credit rationing. The governments will fight against this, of course, and do what they can, and they'll have some success. But the principles of banking are the principles of banking. And so, you know, I expect we'll see a lot of tightening of credit around small and medium-sized business, and then we'll get on to housing next, of course, which will probably, you know, experience similar dynamics as well. And so when you're looking for the V-shaped recovery, you're really assuming that there'll be no banking damage done, and they'll just be ready and fresh and prepared to lend, and I don't think that's going to be the case. So, I mean, that scenario is more L-shaped than it is V, and best case is probably U.
I wrote a piece last week on banks themselves and just about the yield curve, and it's slightly technical, but basically in the end, the simple version is that banks borrow in the short-term markets and lend out at a long-term rate. So they borrow at a short-term rate, lend at a long-term rate. And so the actual level of interest rates doesn't matter as much to bank profitability as what it does is how steep that yield curve is. And the issue is, as we got to zero, that already stopped paying interest on most transaction accounts, and you know, lowering interest rates on savings accounts. So there's not much more they can do on that front. And then you have this what we call a very flat yield curve. So it's actually not it doesn't incentivize banks to actually get out and lend. And that's one of the big problems they've had in Europe just over the last few years is that they've had such a flat yield curve that they're sort of stuck in this part about trying to keep the yield curve low so that they can stimulate the economy without sending their banks broke. And so they're trying to, you know, walk that line. And that's exactly where Australia is going to be over the next few years, is trying to walk that same line of how do I keep interest rates low enough that I can get the economy going without sending my banks broke and getting them or making it at least a disincentive for them to actually lend money so that they just sort of sit back and do the easy stuff and try not to invest in
properties. The global Japan, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. So
very good. Well, look, whilst talking about that, maybe we can pivot across to the property markets if we want to open up on a new topic.
Well, this is where it'll get really cheery. I wrote a piece earlier in the week saying I expect that Scott Morrison will own a part of most people's homes by the end of the year. That was a cheeky way of saying that I think the banks are headed for some kind of partial nationalisation at the end of this.
Yep.
It's just such an immense shock economically. And as I say, these things come through the funnel, but they always end up in the banks. We're obviously going to see a freeze in property demand for the next 6 months. And it may be a complete freeze, you know, like almost no transactions. I mean, as much as anything else, the social distancing is obviously something that is entirely hostile to property. You add sentiment to that. A 6 month zero volume property market, well, pick a number in terms of price fall. It's much less like last year and much more again like 1991, where you just gap lower somehow. You're into the implications discussed in the last segment, which is what does it do to banks? You're obviously going to see a lot of unemployment come out of this. Again, governments will do their best, but they're going to be chasing something that moves far faster than they do. Underemployment and unemployment are going to skyrocket. So there's another wave of bad debt for the banks to chew through. I expect we'll probably also see a tightening of credit naturally as that transpires for the housing market. I expect to see price falls, significant price falls. I saw Nigel Stapledon, who's a sort of legendary name in the property circles in Australia, professor, this morning at The Guardian talking about how it will be a V-shaped recovery and by 2021 we'll be back to where we started. I find that very difficult to believe. Again, this would look more like a shunt lower and an L-shaped recovery to me. You've got to chew through all that bad debt and everything else. And then there's beyond the virus, there's going to be all sorts of sort of political unknowns. I think what comes after the virus, quite frankly, is revolution. I don't know how it will transpire where, but there's going to be a lot of dead people, a lot of angry people, and globalization is going to be seriously on the nose. So,
and when you say revolution,
how does that play out in Australia?
When you say revolution, Dave, we're not talking about guns and it's more a revolution at the poll box in most countries, but maybe guns in some countries, but yeah.
In most countries, absolutely, in most countries. Some places it'll probably be pitchforks and torches, but most, yes, absolutely, most places, and certainly in lazy fat Australia it will be at the ballot box. But I'm thinking in terms of, you know, we're going to see zero immigration for the next six to 12 months. Firstly, because the borders will be shut. Second, because there'll be no jobs. So, you know, actually immigration demand will collapse. But then after that, you know, like there are simple facts like, you know, population growth has taken our beds per head from a dozen to four over the last 15 years. Now, if it's handled badly and the death rate's much higher, you know, then people will want to see that number reversed. How does that fit with population growth? Obviously, the virus came from China. You know, that's going to create all sorts of, you know, bitterness in the community. I don't know how it plays out, but all I can say is that the simple assumption that we're going to go back to importing hundreds of thousands of people per annum and pump priming property demand has to be under question as well, longer term. But I guess shorter term, the issue is the banks and the big fat property demand freeze, which are going to be pretty serious.
Yeah. So the other side of that, David, is there's what a lot of people are pitching is right. People are going to look at the stock market and go, "Hey, that's far too scary, far too volatile. I'm putting my money back in houses where it's nice and safe, and I can see it, and I know where it is." So, what do you?
Yeah. Well, not if property falls as well.
absolutely.
But maybe. I mean.
Yeah. The issue I've got, I'm not arguing that's the case. I think there might be I've called it the Wile E. Coyote moment, and I don't know how long it's going to last for. And the thing is here, I wrote something up on all our blogs last week as well on this, just saying, you know, the share market was in this at the end of January and early February, where we could see what was happening in China. We could see all the cases doubling outside China every few days, but it was sort of, it was just ignoring it, and it was sort of in that Wile E. Coyote. It's off the edge of the cliff, but hasn't actually fallen yet. That's why I think the property market is as well. And I wonder if there might be a couple of months of that where people are trying to put their money into housing. But the question is, for me, is unemployment. Housing markets, as much as everyone wants them to go up, as much as governments will want them to go up, if unemployment rate rises significantly, then houses fall because people sell their houses because they just have to. And it doesn't take a huge proportion in that. We saw that from 2012 to 17 in Perth, where you know, we had this massive boom in the eastern states, but under exactly the same credit conditions and everything like that, but with rising unemployment, and didn't even rise that far, sort of about 2% in Perth, we saw property prices falling for that whole time. And that's my take, is that I think
absolutely
you'll go through this period where you have a I don't know how long this Wile E. Coyote moment will last, where the prices stay where they are, but then once unemployment really starts to bite and people start selling because they have to, that's where I don't think property prices can withstand that.
I think you're right. Yep, very good.
I mean, I suppose the other positive you might try to find in it is foreign demand. You know, like post the virus experience in China, that we see a wave of foreign money into property. I don't know. I mean, that probably hangs on how each respective country handles the virus and the fallout.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that we're going to come out looking any better than China, to be honest.
No, and there was a lot of talk in the early days about how you know, you see money coming from Hong Kong, people just giving up and going, "Look, that's it. I've had enough." You know, all the protests and there, it does look as if China's using the sort of cover of the coronavirus to put a few more checks onto the Hong Kong market. But Hong Kong's done way better at containing this than what Australia has, and so there's almost an argument could even go the other way, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, I do think we've butchered this to some extent in terms of letting the virus in. Mm. As you pointed out, we were too slack, too complacent, too early, and and you know, obviously, even last week, you know, you had the government putting out a stimulus package which was targeting to get people out and shopping. You know,
yeah.
I mean, they simply had not moved beyond their basic political value system of wanting to avoid a recession for one quarter, and hadn't realised that what they were doing was catastrophic. And that's a week ago. Yeah. So, you know, for the last couple of months when the virus has been coming in and, you know, kind of steadily pushing further and further out, you know, they've just let that go.
Yeah. And if we were in winter, we would be Italy or the US or France or Germany, whatever. Yeah, pick your country.
Yeah.
We've certainly done nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing great compared to any other country in terms of trying to slow it down.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we'll jump across to our next topic, which was stimulus. We have touched on this a little bit over the last handful of topics, but was there anything point to note to sort of kick off where we might see some stimulus? You were talking before we've got a Reserve Bank, emergency Reserve Bank meeting coming up. Was it this week?
Yeah. David? Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the Reserve's going to cut the last 25 and start QE. I'm hopeful it'll be yield curve control. So I think we'll see stabilisation in the bond curve. And that's about all it can do. I mean, it'll have its various funding facilities for the banks to stop, you know, a funding cost spike calamity. It'll do all those things that it can do, liquidity wherever it's needed, wherever the debt starts to seize up. But that isn't going to stop any kind of economic fallout. It just stops it from becoming, a financial catastrophe and making the economic fallout much worse. So you're almost heading off a counterfactual rather than, you know, making things better. There's not a whole lot that the central banks can do beyond that. I'm sure they'll succeed in doing that much. And then we go over to fiscal, and this is where, you know, we need to tear up the rule book. You know, the $19 billion last week was a joke. Way too small, like way too small. There are analysts out there saying we're going to end up spending. What's that?
And
very poorly targeted. Yeah, poorly targeted, and actually, you know, running in complete contradiction to other parts of the policy. You know, like on one hand, saying we're trying to shut down to prevent the spread. On the other hand, here's $750 to go out and shop like, you know, shop till you're dead in the local mall. So, very poor effort first round, despite the fact that all the captured economists celebrated it. So they've gone back to the drawing board now, but I still think that they're far behind the curve. What they basically need to do is just drop a bomb on Newstart, just give anyone who's unemployed heaps of money, and open up some credit lines for small business. You know, this is what Germany's done. Increasingly, various other countries are doing. Just get a lot of liquidity and money out to small businesses, grants, zero interest loans, BAS forgiveness, everything to just stop good businesses from going bust during this.
Yep.
Because obviously, a total economic freeze does not discriminate.
Yeah.
Between good and bad businesses.
I'd love to see the two phases though, as well, as saying that there needs to be distinctly one phase is how do we keep people in quarantine and actually encourage them to be in quarantine without sort of trying to get them to break it just to get money through. And then the second step is how do we stimulate the economy after we're coming out of that quarantine? Because if you stimulate at the first part, you lose it all because you're like, let's throw all this money into stimulating an economy where people are just sitting at home anyway. So there's, needs to be two phases.
So, I mean, Pendle yesterday quoted, you know, it was going to be, about a $400 billion end cost, maybe 20% of GDP for most economies. That seemed to me to be a reasonable estimate. Basically, you can assume that by the end of this year, ScoMo is going to own a lot of Australia.
So on the stimulus side then as well, is the other thing is it is worth noting, you know, from that, the point I was making the other day is that we've already used most of the good policy options just trying to keep the house price keep the highest prices high. This is the thing we've been arguing for the last year or two, is we're throwing all this policy measures trying to keep house prices high, and when you get an external shock, then we won't have the good policy measures to actually help prop it up. We'll be left with the bad ones, and that's exactly where we are now. Is you know, I think our government is pretty housing focused, and they're probably going to start rolling out more measures to try and keep house prices high. And we've got no idea what they'll be, but we're pretty sure there's not going to be any gems in there, given that you know, most of the traditional ones you do when you have a housing market crash is you start loosening up lending standards, and you get first home buyers grants and all these other factors you start putting in to sort of bring forward demand. We already did that last year, trying to bring forward demand to keep house prices, you know, where they were. So, yeah, it's lots of firepower.
Absolutely, That's right. When you've got talk of like Austria banning public gatherings of more than five people, and I think Trump just said something this morning about banning anyone, any group over 10, that's going to be a little bit limiting on auction numbers if we do something similar over here.
Absolutely.
That up. Very good. Okay. Well, look, we'll turn around to the question of the day, I guess. And this is the when to buy question. Obviously, there's a potential of a white swan event.
Before we do this, I might just run quickly through some of the questions that are on the blog to give a quick one-liner for some of them. Somebody's asking a question about whether Vanguard will be bailed out or nationalized. No, I don't think so. I think they're most of the guys that are running index funds and factors like that, they've got pretty low costs, and I don't think that's a major issue for us. Some of the leveraged ETFs, and there will certainly be lots of funds that lock up. So the big issue is if you're in debt ETFs, if you're in you might think you've got liquidity, but you don't, because they've generally got very illiquid underlyings. And it's not just ETFs, it's also managed funds. So debt, property, infrastructure funds, private equity, all these types of things are most likely going to lock up. And so you'll sort of have to sit and wait, similar to the financial crisis, where you just had to wait a year or so before you can actually start taking your money out again. Questions on whether the government's been late to the party. Absolutely, and so we continue to expect them to be late to the party. We've got a question there about what's the impact of the banks if the government's too late. Look, the banks will. You know, if the government's too late on the banks, you know, you have to worry about whether the banks go under. But I think there is enough focus on that. I don't think they'll be late to party on the banks, mainly because the banks, or certainly the big ones, have a direct line through to both the RBA and to Morrison to ask for help when things start to look dire. So I don't think that's a likely scenario, but it is possible. There's lots of questions about what to do with your money, in terms of saying, you know, is it safe to put your money in the bank and those types of factors. As we've said a few times on this, we think that if governments start letting, if you give money to a bank, you're basically as a deposit, you're the most secure in terms of that whole factor. There's a whole range of people. Equity holders are the first to lose money, and then there's some hybrid debt holders and some tier one capital holders, tier two capital holders that will sort of lose. And then you start working your way through all these different debt tranches. If it gets to the stage where people who have put deposits in are starting to lose money, we don't think that's going to happen. But secondly, we do think governments own a big enough printing press that they can prevent that from happening, and that if they don't prevent it from happening, that's basically letting your government. That's basically assigning your party into opposition for the next generation.
For eternity.
Yes, that's right. Questions on Nucleus funds and when to give us money. Sort of, I can't answer that with a. Without disclaiming that always, you know, we always think it's a good time to give us money. So, but the big question is, do you trust yourself to buy back into the market when everyone's negative on it? And so the issue at the moment is everyone's trying to catch this falling knife, and there was stuff, you know, the markets fell 10%, and people were out there saying, oh, you know, it's a buying opportunity of a lifetime, and we were sort of going, well, no, we don't think it is, and we think that's going to continue, is that you're going to see it's not going to turn around within such a short period of time, and still we start seeing clarity about how much money companies are going to be down in terms of profits and what the economic effects will be. So we have various things we're doing. We're switching between bonds, different foreign currencies. We think we're doing what we can to protect the capital of the people we have, but also picking up stocks that have fallen too far. And so, we'd pitched it, you know, for people. We pitched it. What we're treating our existing client capital the same as we're treating somebody that gives us money today. So if somebody gives us money today and says, "Well, you've already bought these things and they've already performed really well," is we're saying, "Well, yes, we did, but we're treating every investment that we've got as well. Forget what the past performance is. We're caring about whether this thing's going to keep protecting us or it's going to protect us going forward. Have we taken our kids out of school? Yes. There's I've taken my vulnerable kids out of school and the ones that are doing their final year of school. No, they're on their own, but I think they'll be shortly out of school anyway. We can hear your kids in the background there, David.
Yes, my kids are at home. Yeah. Yes.
So and look, in the end, it is more of a factor of saying, I do think if you can prevent the spread of the disease, even if you're not at risk, then that's a good thing. And so if there's things you can do to socially distance, then do it. Because the issue isn't that not many people die, and especially younger people, not that many younger people die. It's that we absolutely don't want our hospitals swamped. Because if our hospitals are swamped with coronavirus patients and you have a car accident, then you won't get the service that you won't get the care that you need because they're too busy dealing with other people. And so that's one factor that doesn't that you don't see in the stats. So even though you got quite high stats in Italy of all these people and they're literally deciding, here's somebody who's 90, they're not getting a machine. Here's somebody who's 45 with three kids. Okay, we'll give them a bed. That types of decisions that
they can leave. Yeah.
That's one part, but the second part is there's people turning up there with other things and going, "Well, I've got a cancer that should be dealt with," and it's like, "Well, yes, but you're gonna have to wait a week longer than what you would have normally had to wait for because we just don't have the facilities for it," and you don't see the rise in mortality in those other ones when that happens. So yeah, any social distancing you can do, we highly recommend it. Cash deposits. I don't know, David. Is there any questions there you wanted to you wanted to answer in particular?
I'm just saying childcare centres, would they close? Yes, I think that's likely, along with schools. What else have we got? What's happened to Aussie government bonds? Well, that was simply the dislocation of last week. I think the RBA is onto that, and I think it'll wash out in time. In terms of selling bonds, look, that's a horizon question. If you're looking medium term, then yes, because bonds are extremely highly priced now. In the short term, we're still comfortable that, they've got room to move higher as QE comes on board and the economic shock arrives following the market shock. Crazy John Adams is not on the panel, no. My question... entry into the MB fund, well, as Dana says, whenever you like is good.
And there's a few specific questions that Tim will get back to you, I think, directly on some of the questions that probably better off not to give personal advice over the podcast.
Yeah, no, look, just to expand a little bit on that, but and that might just give us a little bit of a segue into that when to buy sort of component of our chat as well, just mindful of time. But, as you said, Damien, I think correctly, it's the when to buy thing is from a retail investor's standpoint, you've got a limited amount of time to think about when you're going to shift a big amount of money. From an institutional investor's standpoint, and I guess sitting on the other side of the frame from the retail, when you're looking at it every day, you've the opportunity to drip money into the markets and to make either the hedge the decision across a broader time period, I think just gives you, it's more advantageous if you think of it that way. But it does really come down to a level of comfort with the investor. Okay, now I'm ready to hand over some money to put in the markets, or do I want to let the pros do it and they can manage it for me as well? And obviously, you've got the transparency of what we're doing behind the scenes in the way that we've set everything up. So
And we do think like
my working.
So you go, David.
Oh, well, just in terms of when to buy, my working model for that is, you know, these things generally run from market shock to economic shock. And the initial market panic, for the most part, in these things tends to bottom as the economic panic takes off. So we're not yet into the economic panic. That lies ahead. And so as a basic operating principle, the way I think about these things is I'll be looking for when everybody starts to see the economy fall into the abyss and starts freaking out that it's the absolute end of the world. That's around the time when you get the realistic reassessment of corporate profits and when you might get a bottoming in equities.
Mm. Interesting. And actually, just on a side note on that, when to buy, I've been speaking to a lot of clients, obviously, over the last month who have been talking a lot about gold. Do you mind just sharing with us your thoughts on gold, Damien and David, into these sort of, cataclysmic market events?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's a conversation I've had repeatedly over the last decade because we have got, a number of people who hold physical gold that are involved with the MB Fund. And I've made the point repeatedly that when the panic does come, gold tends to actually disappoint in terms of safe havens because for, similar reasons to what we've described around, the sovereign debt dislocation and various other things, the risk parity funds, other things going haywire in markets, gold can get liquidated when there's just a massive margin call and hedge funds and other funds need money. And gold's liquidity gets dumped. And so when you're expecting gold to go up, it gets hammered. And that's started to happen over the last couple of weeks. Gold spiked into the prices and it's now getting sold. The damage so far is relatively minimal, but I wouldn't necessarily assume that that would hold. I think during the GFC it fell about 30%. A similar outcome might be possible if equities continue to fall. But the good news is, that is the time to start buying gold because, coming out of that liquidation, you're going to see this extraordinary debasement of currencies, as central banks look to monetize a lot of this economic damage via fiscal. And that's, an environment in which gold will prosper. And so buying gold into the crisis liquidation is a pretty good kind of strategy for rises afterwards.
Okay. So after the crash?
Well, we're in the crash now. I wouldn't necessarily be picking up gold yet because I think there's more to come in the crash and probably therefore more gold liquidation. But just it goes back to your question, your sort of framework about how you best handle these things, whether you can do it in one hit or you've got the time to dollar average. But as a basic principle, buying gold into these kind of shock liquidations that are followed by massive liquidity injections is a good strategy because it's likely that gold will rise coming out of the crisis, especially when the Fed is so dominant. We're going to see the US dollar rise through the crisis. It has been so far. Even shrugged off what was initially a sort of carry trade reversal in the euro, and has now kind of reverted to mean where you've got a dollar shortage as this financial crisis develops. And so I'd expect the US dollar to keep going up, and that will also pressure gold in the short term. But my point is, if you're buying, during that liquidation, then I would expect gold to be going up after it's into the recovery.
Okay. Yeah, great point. And Damien, when to buy? What are you looking for? What are the key signs?
We need to get some clarity on earnings. That's a big one, and that's not going to happen for months. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm certainly not rushing to put money in at the moment. I think there's parts where I'm considering sort of nibbling away at the edges, and we have been looking at some of our bond positions, which have been performed really well, and where we can switch those. We're looking at currencies in terms of which currencies we're holding our cash in. So most of it has been held in US cash, but we've also had a few others that are in there. So for me, it's very much still about the protection. I think you're getting when you're seeing such wild swings in markets, you generally don't see a day when the whole crisis finishes. There's not really a day where everyone decides that was it, and the market rallies 10-20% on over the next week. It usually is you get a bit of a decent sized bottoming process, and so we're not in a hurry to try and catch sort of any falling knives at the moment. We think there are assets out there that can protect you, but we need to be careful about which ones they are and at what stage we're rotating into those assets. So and the big one for our for people who have just invested directly in our stock portfolio. So we've got two sets of people. Most people give us money with a tactical bent where we can switch it between cash and bonds and equities. Some people have given us money just in equities and say, we just want you to invest in, we want you to be fully invested at all times. And so for those ones, we switched very much defensive, and we're still working through those issues at the moment. So like, for example, some of our funds are, I think our Australian funds are like 7% outperformed the market or something over this month so far. And our international sort of almost 5%. But what that actually means is we've got a bunch of stocks in there that are just, the rest of the market's fallen 30% and they've fallen 15 or fallen 10 or some of them, and some of them have even risen. But it just means that now they're looking very expensive relative to the others. And so really for us, it's trying to manage this next stage of, okay, we want to start tipping out of some of these more expensive stocks because, yes, it was exciting that whatever, they had a cure or they were the, we had the world's largest maker of hand sanitizer or Clorox, which is one of the world's biggest cleaning products, and bleach and all that kind of stuff, disinfectants. So nice to have those ones, but they're not companies which over the long term you sort of go, yes, this is going to be a great long-term growth story, and so I'm happy to pay whatever 25 times earnings for it. There is a point where you just have to say, well, it's just so expensive that I actually need to tip into other ones. And so that's what we're spending our days doing, is just sort of drawing up our shopping lists and checking which companies we want to buy. Those companies become relatively cheaper versus other ones, we're starting to look to switch into those.
And so in that sort of zone with those full equity portfolios, and obviously that's some terrific outperformance there, has it been more a factor of avoiding losers or picking winners, do you think?
Or both? Avoiding losers. Well, actually, yeah. We basically go with quality and value is our mix. So we have a matrix where we rank everything on one axis by quality and everything on the other axis by value, and we try and buy stuff that fits fits under the curve, so to speak. And so what we tend to find is that we'll buy average quality stocks need to be really cheap before we buy them, whereas high quality stocks we can handle them being a bit more expensive. So quality and value both tend to perform better as markets are falling. So we sort of feel as if we're in a natural situation where the stocks we're buying will naturally do a bit better. But for us, it's been about trying to say, well, there's banks out there, say European banks, that did look like they were very good value before. But we still didn't want to step into that area. Or energy stocks, certainly very much avoiding those. We've ditched all our travel stuff. So airlines almost always look cheap. But that was certainly not the type of stock you wanted to own coming into that. So I guess within the quality value space, for us, it's about trying to manage which of the stocks and which of the sectors we wanted to avoid going into this. And now it's a question of, if there are ones out there that are, there's travel stocks out there that are going to do a very, very tough over the next sort of 6 months or a year, but some of them have got bucket loads of cash. And if you strip the cash out of the business, they're trading on, very low PEs, sort of, four or five times on. And so you say, if earnings quarter for, if they lose 75% of their earnings for a year or two, you're buying it on 20 times, but if the earnings then bounce back to be, whatever it is, 40% lower than what they used to be, then you're still picking this stock up at a decent price, and you'll probably be happy with it in the longer term. So there's certainly babies being thrown out with the bathwater, but avoiding companies with high levels of debt. That was the first thing we did as soon as not that we buy companies with high levels of debt to start with, but we really just went through our portfolio and just went, anything that's got too much debt is just out the door, because they're the ones you want to make sure the companies will still be around at the end of it. And that's where the danger is that if you're carrying too much debt and you have a supply shock and a demand shock, maybe the company doesn't make it.
Yeah, sure. All right, very good. We might finish it up there, gents, on the basis that we've run very much over time on a huge emergency podcast. So thanks very much for sharing your thoughts. And I hope that helps buoy some confidence in a very low confidence world out there as well for those listening in. And I'll just give a quick plug to our Thursday. Our regular program will be resuming on Thursday at 12:30. We're speaking with Jonathan Rockford, who interestingly is well and truly in the depths of the Australian alternate credit markets. So I think we'll look forward to a fascinating chat there on this very topic and just hear right from the coalface.
Yeah, and actually,
what's going on?
I was just talking to Jonathan yesterday, actually, because it's last time we spoke to him when we had him on the podcast last time, he was talking about saying, because he does a lot of distressed debt, and he was just saying there's nothing out there to buy. And so there's stuff out there to buy for him now, though. So, yes.
The world has changed. The world has changed. So we look forward to that one. So we'll catch everyone there. And on that note, thanks for your attention, and we'll be back soon.